take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/popcastpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/popcastpod.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your racking out at Barney's in its final days, or maybe just racking, of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. We're back. It's part two of the listener mailbag. I'm not going to say what we were just listening to, but if you're the person who emailed me to ask me to play that song, you're welcome. Joe and Karen are still here. Questions are still here. JP calling in later. Let's get him moving. Karen, I'm glad that you haven't left yet. Glad that we haven't scared you.
The clock is ticking.
I'm glad that we haven't left yet because Michael Harris is back with another question. Michael Harris had the Mitski question. And Michael, I think Michael Harris is maybe particularly tuned in to the dynamic here. So Michael says, from listening to the Grammys podcast, I am reminded of Karen's take on Big Thief. Yeah, we're going there. I am curious what the rest of the Popcast squad thinks of Big Thief and whether they are deserving of the critical praise received in 2019. I find their music to be both disquieting and soothing and ultimately original. Michael, I appreciate the question. You may get dragged. Sorry. So, Karen.
We stand with Karen.
First of all, we stand with Karen even when Karen's not completely right.
Wow.
Do you stand with Karen?
I don't
Karen
feel
when
totally
she's,
stood I support.
I am like the ACLU. I will defend to the death the right for you to have the opinion that you have, even if it is not good.
I don't think that's true, but continue.
We will actually physically fight about Yummy before the end of the day, but go on.
Before the end of the hour, perhaps. So, Karen, can you situate people who maybe are not as extremely online as Michael, yourself, Joe Coscarelli, and John Caramonica? Actually, I'm trying to be less online, just to be fair.
There is a band called Big Thief. They put out 2 records last year that were very critically acclaimed.
Did they? Woo!
I listened to them, and I did not like them. I read the very glowing Pitchfork review, which directed me to some live performances. I watched them. I watched the Colbert performance.
Did your due diligence?
I did. And after doing all this, I decided that, A, they're not good, and B, they're overrated, which are 2 separate things. One has to do with media hype. One has to do with skill.
I'm dead.
I mean, listen, it was an unpleasant tweet cycle for me.
Karen got dragged by every male music
critic outside
of this building.
Every white male critic who has not worked for the New York
Times.
It's
fine. We can all have differing opinions.
Wait,
the issue here was
What did you tweet?
I said that they were the Emperor's New Clothes of 2019 rock.
And that is, frankly, very temperate, I think.
I thought it was temperate. I actually feel stronger than that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. It's a very temperate tweet.
I'm not a dramatic tweeter, John.
People love this band.
They really love Big Thief.
Yeah, there's a lot of emotion. Just like when you were talking about Pine Grove earlier.
Yeah,
I was going to say Pine Grove is my Big Thief.
Wow.
I'm not immune to the idea that people get something from listening to them, that they relate to them and
also,
they connect to
as
them.
A person who has been on the receiving end of your intensity about certain musical artists, I know you know what it is like to stan.
Of course. When people tell me they hate Madonna all the time, I don't tweet at them that they should die. I'm like, oh, that's a bad opinion, but whatever.
No, you just text us. Yeah.
Don't reveal my secrets.
So you tweeted this thing, and for about 24 to 36 hours, the rock crit, in so much as there are still rock critics, rock crit Twitter just
lost their minds.
Yeah, no, it was nuts. It was like the Iowa caucuses. Nobody can make
sense. But for indie rock.
Yes, it was just wild. And people could not They cannot accept that this opinion existed in the world. Perhaps they could not accept that a woman had this opinion.
That seemed to be part of it.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, just out here guessing that. If you are the type of person who listens to podcasts but also tweeted a bad thing at Karen, like, just don't listen to podcasts. Like, we don't need you. Like, don't be like that. Big Thief, it's not it.
We're the only publication that covers contemporary music probably that has not written about Big Thief. And that's because, you know, to pull back the curtain a little bit, like every time a Big Thief release is coming out, we all listen to it and we all shrug. And it's just not doing it for us. So get your Big Thief content elsewhere.
And here's the thing. Like we are – and I want to say –
there's no shortage of it.
No, there's definitely no shortage of it. And I do want to say for people who are listening who are fans of artists that we don't cover or maybe who are publicists of artists that we don't cover – it's not strictly speaking that we have to like something.
No, yes.
There are plenty of things that we cover. Like we have had conversations about any number of artists where we're like, should we review this? And we're all kind of like, we're not into it, but it's meaningful. And we should say that it's not good. Like someone should just get out there.
Or we should just discuss it in some way.
Exactly. And like I think there was a moment where I was like, should I review the Big Thief record to be clear that this is not it? It doesn't do it. And we ultimately decided against that. I'm not in any way connected to what happened on Twitter. We ultimately decided against it. But I do think it's not simply like we all shrug and then there's no way that that artist could get covered. But there were so many layers with the Big Thief thing where I think we felt like, speaking of things like punching above their weight a little bit, like the amount of attention the Big Thief was getting was so disproportionate to ultimately the size of the band and also the quality of the music that I think we all just figured – let's just let it pass.
And that
doesn't mean that we won't return to it. It doesn't mean that I won't on the next record.
We listened to each release completely separately, you know, with fresh ears, looking for something to hear in it. I was going to say, it's not if you do not get your Big Thief content here, it was on Barack Obama's year-end playlist.
Good Lord.
Go there.
Wow. You literally said go.
Just go look at it for as long as it takes for you
stare
to feel good about
feel
who likes Big Thief.
Can I also put in one question that is sort of a critique of the Grammys episode?
Mm.
That's not
the critique. We had a lot of them.
Yeah, that's not the critique that the person who wrote that the Grammys episode was our version of a podcast version of I Sing the Body Electric performance.
Right, which was a great tweet.
So good. Really glad to have received that email. So this came from... and this is going to be interesting when we think about how we choose what we cover. This is something I think we should think about. This comes from Dylan Garcia. This came – I don't remember if it was specific to the Popcast mailbag. I think it might have come after the Grammys, and I just sort of have adopted it for this. Listening to the podcast this week, and it was just another reminder about how the NYT / music media in general is so New York-centric. Because in Austin, Gary Clark Jr. is the most famous musician, to the point where the Dixie Chicks are opening for him in a few weeks.
Is that true?
I mean, I don't – I'm not – what do I look like? Googled
that?
It? Okay, fine. I'll Google
I believe it.
It. Let me Google it.
That is a heinous thing to hear.
Gary Clark.
Put some respect on the name Natalie of Maines. The Dixie Chicks.
We made a mini documentary at Rolling Stone on Gary Clark Jr. and a childhood friend.
ACL Live, Gary Clark Jr. with special appearance by the Dixie
Chicks.
Yeah,
it does sound like opening.
That sounds like a warm-up gig for the return of the Queens.
First of all, he's definitely the bigger photo.
Sure. They're opening. Fine. But it's only because they're just getting their feet wet.
Fine.
To come back and end Gary Clark's
career.
Wait, Karen, finish your story.
I just also
want to
say I did see the Dixie Chicks open for the Eagles.
the most popular band
in American history. And I want to say, you know how much – this is before Karen's time, before your time. But like when I primarily reviewed concerts at the New York Times, that was my job. I mean, my job title remains the same, but my tasks were primarily reviewing concerts. And I was very faithful. You know, me and JP would talk all the time about best practices. And like if I ever had any questions, I would say like, what do I do in this circumstance? What do I do this? Now, the Dixie Chicks were at some point, this was the first step in their comeback, quote unquote comeback. And they were opening for a couple of dates for the Eagles.
It's just Eagles, actually.
I don't care.
Karen editing.
I want to say emphatically, I don't care.
It's both.
I was a fact checker.
It's both. Here's the thing.
It's colloquially said the Eagles, but it is just Eagles in print.
Carry on. I don't care. I'm telling you.
It's the
same
with the Pixies.
I'm looking you in your eyes. I don't care. Here's the thing.
Wait, one pause. I got a text after the Grammys episode, and it was the best podcast related texts I've gotten, and also the pithiest, and it was just Karen has a really hard job.
Oh my God, you didn't send that to me?
I needed to save it for on air.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. So
I feel so seen.
The point is the Dixie Chicks have opened before, but the reason I brought that up is because the one of the first rule breaking decisions I made working in the New York Times pop music critic, they were opening for Eagles, not to be confused with Eagles. And I remember emailing or calling JP and being like, I have no interest at all in reviewing the Eagles show. Like, I don't want to have to sit through.
Can you just do the Dixie Chicks?
That's what I'm saying. Like, I don't, like, I just.
Well, now I would have said sure.
Well, no, but he said, you should do the whole show. And I was like, thank you for that opinion. And then I didn't. I just did the Dixie Chicks.
Who was your editor then?
Fletch.
And he was fine with it?
I think so. I mean, he was fine with everything. Fletch was good with everything. Shouts to Fletch Daddy Dollars, who we miss all the time. And I did that, and actually, I was punished because it is almost impossible to get a bus. I did not drive for whatever reason that day, and I was trying to get some kind of transportation out of Giant Stadium.
Oh, yeah.
And there were no buses that would take
– You got stuck?
I got stuck there, and I met two very lovely young women, and we all called a cab together and took a cab to the train and took a train back to Manhattan because they also had only gone for the Dixie Chicks. But anyway, the Dixie Chicks, I understand, occasionally will open for people, but Gary Clark Jr. is not the Eagles.
One other note on the last podcast, though. Ben Cesaria sadly couldn't be on it because he was flying back from the Grammys. We were talking by my desk, and Wesley said, you know, oh, was it too loud? Were John and I too much? And Ben said, no, you were like the Real Housewives of the podcast. Which is seriously, nothing has made me happier than that.
Oh, man. Ben Cesaria. Praise. I can't believe that pith is not here in person today.
Ben is out sick, but with us in spirit.
So, okay, but now to circle back. Now that we've all patted ourselves on the back for the radical acts of coverage that we have done.
We? Why are you saying we?
First of all, well, Karen out here copy editing me in real time. She's patting herself on the back. I'm patting myself on the back. You're out here reading text. Like, we're all in our feelings. We're all doing well. So, Gary Clark Jr., very famous.
In Austin.
In one city.
Right, fine.
Dylan, I'm not trying to.
Macklemore is really famous in Seattle still, I'm sure.
And like Stockholm. Right. Like probably like certain.
Australia.
Yeah, like Finnish towns. But, like,
I don't have like an actual issue with Gary Clark Jr. And I do think that last album was fine. It's just, I think we can all agree that he has an outsized presence on the Grammys.
Yeah, no. So this is, yeah, and, this and is Dylan, not a, and just again, a I'm not trying to dig Dylan, because I think Dylan is trying to like open our eyes a little bit.
Yes.
And I think
which JP did as well.
And this is totally fair to have our eyes open. But I do think that Gary Clark Jr.'s fame is very, very localized. I acknowledge that there is a micro sliver of the country in which Gary Clark Jr. is hugely famous. But if that is the metric by which we are going to allow people to be performing for like 17 minutes on the Grammys.
Claro.
Yeah. I mean, there are any, give me any, very give famous me in any Brooklyn. State, give me any city that's Austin-like, and I'm sure that there is a Gary Clark Jr. Like, I'm sure if you go to Denver, there's like all those like kind of bad, like trippy, fake hip hop, electronic music, like two bros. Like, why not have them for 17 minutes on the Grammys? Why not have, like, some local mini, like, you know, like, Dessa from Minneapolis play 17 minutes on the Grammys? Like, why not have Lil Durk play 17 minutes on the Grammys?
We've now given the Gary Clark Jr. conversation 17 minutes on the podcast.
You know, I mean, the point is, yes. There is the Gary Clark Jr. curiosity stands, regardless of his fame in Austin and regardless of the fact of the Dixie Chicks opening for him. Here's one that I think we all probably have been thinking about a lot in the wake of the Grammys. So this is coming from Myles Greenblatt. And actually, before we do it, do you guys know that song Trampoline by Shade?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. How you pronounce it?
I think so. Do you want to hear it? Do you want to hear it again?
Just, sure.
Okay.
It's like it's Spotify core.
Yes. And there's like a remix with Zayn.
Speaking of comebacks.
Speaking. I mean, you had to have been on the top.
Jumping on a trampoline, flipping in the air. I never land, just float a bit. As I'm looking up, suddenly the sky erupts. Flames alert the trees, spread to fallen leaves. Now they're right upon me. Wait if I'm so deep in love when I dream of dying. I never feel so loved.
and dreams, splashing in the summer stream, tripping, I fall in, I wanted it to happen, my body turns to ice, crushing weight of pain.
So Miles Greenblatt, who goes to Cornell, it seems, or at least did, he has a Cornell email address.
Be a professor.
Wow, true story. Miles, are you a professor? Let me know. Oh, nope. Well, unless he's like a Doogie Howser, because the first here's the first sentence of Miles' email, which is, I wanted to let you know that you do have teenage listeners.
Oh, nice. Aww.
Such as this one who loved the show and wanted to ask this question. Shouts to Miles and all his teenage listener friends. Here's Miles' question. Is it fair to call Trampoline by Shade? Again, I think that's how it's pronounced.
S-H-A-E-D. Also, is it like a weird symbol sometimes, like where the A and the E are combined?
Yes.
I don't know the name of that symbol.
Is it fair to call Trampoline by Shade post-Billie Eilish music? The panning bass and nearly every other effect in the song and low-key percussion feel very reminiscent of Finneas's production. The vocals on the chorus, from the way the first line is layered to the ah between lines, sound right out of her Don't Smile at Me EP. The whistling in the second chorus just completed the effect. But first of all,
coming for your job.
Miles, I was going to say, does Miles want to be a New York Times pop music critic?
So Miles can have my job. Yeah. This is a two-part question. One, that's the musical part. Here's the other part, which I know Joe and I imagine Ben, if he was here, would have something to say about. More generally, I know you have talked about labels trying to replicate her sound and success. Is it too early to call music post-Billy?
So here on Popcast, we call this genre of music Spotify core.
We do.
And
even when it's made by Billie Eilish.
Yes.
And so, it did predate Billie.
Yeah, it predated her. Don't Smile at Me EP is maybe like the adolescence of Spotify core.
Yeah, but I feel like it was like parallel. I feel like I used this analogy in something else recently, Karen, and she would edit this out if she was editing. But like, I think it was like the Leibniz-Newton thing where it's like two people arriving at something at the same time. Mm-hmm. Like I think what Billie and Finneas were doing sort of was happening while basically like 100 faceless Swedish acts and European acts were like arriving at something that was optimized for the streaming ecosystem.
Well, Ocean Eyes came out a long time ago.
Oh, yes.
And it was sort of a blueprint.
But it was sort of a SoundCloud thing more than a Spotify thing. So I don't know if they were in complete conversation with each other. I don't know. Just a thought.
I agree. I think maybe this current was happening.
Diet Eyelash.
Yeah, but it's getting underlined because of the success of Billie's music, and it's like more of that. You know what I mean? Like, people have been trying this. You know, like, to me, the gold standard Spotify core song is that Kiara song.
Oh, the two K-R with two eyes.
Yeah, with the glitchy vocals that plays in Starbucks. Yeah. Like that. And this, to me, is like in that lineage as well. And I think Billie is like the advanced placement course version of that kind of music.
I do not agree with that.
I was going to say, there's also something a lot more edgy and sinister to Billie's music than to the Shade song, which is like dentist music.
Molga.
Which
Tony
is made
Bennett.
For syncs, right? Yeah. Made to be played during commercials.
Did you guys see in the Vogue cover story that Billie said something like kind of messed up about hip hop?
What'd she say?
She was basically like, everybody's lying. It's about like, I got my bitches and I got my gun. And like, I know you and you don't have bitches and you don't have a gun.
She's 18.
Yeah. I mean, she's a young kid. And also rappers be lying.
Of course. Of course, you know, but, you know, Billie Eilish, noted friend of XXXTentacion and other rappers. For someone who borrows so heavily from hip-hop aesthetics, I thought it was a strange position to take in a white magazine.
It's a little 7 p.m. news.
It's very royals.
I believe fundamentally, like, Billie Eilish is, like, a fairly open-minded person and probably has pretty good taste and probably didn't mean for it to come off the way it came off. Yeah. But it does, you know, not to, like, micro-assess everybody's bad interviews because everybody has bad interviews. But I was
Especially teenagers.
Yeah, so I was a little bit surprised. And it made me maybe think, like, oh, all the things that people are putting on Billie Eilish, like, oh, you're cool, you're this, you're progressive, blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, I have often thought that Billie Eilish is like maybe a little bit retrograde from a musical perspective.
Are you putting a different pronunciation of her last name on her?
First of all, I've been on that. So I just want to drive it home again and again.
You've made the point.
I want to drive it home again and again and again. This one comes from someone who edited a story of mine once, who I wrote for her once at a magazine called System, which is a British fashion magazine. This is from Sarah McAlpin. I know Joe's going to be very excited about this question. Sarah is like, John, when can we talk about early noughties pop punk? She's British. Sorry. They say that?
Noughties?
I mean, I assume so. I haven't lived in England since 1999.
Right.
Did you know that John lived in London?
The podcast bingo drinking
did
game.
You know that?
John mentioning his time in London. Classic.
Pop punk, you know I'm talking about emo. Its influence and comeback, not just musically, but in fashion. It's legitimately a runway mood. Sarah, I think, works for Elle now in the UK. So My Chemical Romance announcing a tour, selling out The Used, Taking Back Sunday, Jimmy Eat World, Blink-182, not quite emo. Although that might have been a British perspective, because I actually think, weirdly, it's more emo than some of these other bands. But anyway, it's a different...
Blink-182?
I think in some...
Not the same scene.
No, it's not the same scene. No, definitely not. So there's something to be said of its influence on genre-bending musicians today, too. I'm 98% certain that Tyler, the Creator, has hat-tipped emo in the past and a few artists. You might do a better job of identifying Peep, etc., obviously Juice WRLD, but not Yellow Card, as if. Can we talk about this, get a good cultural history on this? So all things are cyclical, obviously. Did you see the thing about My Chemical Romance getting bumped off of Coachella for Frank Ocean, and then they still make the $4 million because—
Is that a fact?
I think it was a Hits Daily Double thing.
So they were supposed to be a headliner?
They were supposed to be top line, and then Frank got booked last minute, and they got bumped for
Frank.
Well,
lucky for them, Frank's going to cancel anyway. So all you Frank Ocean fans out there buying Coachella tickets, think
Jokes
twice.
On you.
Also, My Chemical Romance tickets went on sale this week, and I have not seen such a frenzy in New York Times Slack. Nobody could get tickets. They sold out immediately, and people were freaking out.
Can you identify some people?
I don't name names on the podcast, but there were many people freaking out about this.
And I have to say, this is a little bit of a detour, but as somebody who lived through this, who lived in Florida and played in an emo band in 2003 or whatever.
I know that's not part of the podcast drinking game, but that's part of the John Caramonica My Life drinking game.
What was Joe's emo band called?
It's not for public consumption.
That's what it was called, not for public consumption.
And trust me, nobody consumed it. But it's crazy to me that My Chemical Romance has come back as like the leaders of this world. Mm-hmm. Like they did have a huge TRL crossover, mm-hmm. which was a little after my time. Mm-hmm. And Helena is maybe one of the top five songs to come out of this entire scene, third wave emo, whatever you want to call it. And yet, I'm just baffled that
they have become
the standard bearer. I mean, to me, all of those bands named in this email other than My Chemical Romance are better. Taking Back Sunday, better.
The Used is not better.
The first Used album.
No, they have a good, that was a good record, but The Used is not
better. Yes, and not a better band.
The Used is not a better band.
Next Wednesday night at Webster Hall, who is going?
Not me.
I'm going to the dog show. But if I wasn't going to the dog show, I was going to the Used.
Okay.
Karen, are you going to go to that festival that I emailed you about?
I'm thinking about it. John sent me a rock festival.
Ryan Sartor, friend of the podcast, sent me a flyer for a 3-day festival in Boston, obviously. That's all
Is it Boston Calling?
Yes. It's like all just rock, 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 rock. And so I sent it to Karen. I said she has to go. It's part of her job.
He said, book your ticket. And I said, to 1994?
Where you already – well, I guess you can't book a ticket to somewhere you already live.
On my way.
To be fair, it's like, why would you do that? So anyway, you might go to that.
I'll go.
To answer my own question, I think that My Chemical Romance is the most ambitious maybe of
most
these
ambitious,
bands.
Most theatrical.
Most theatrical.
Of
and I mean, I think about groups like Brand New. Brand New was canceled.
Yep.
You know, Jesse Lacey was
accused of interacting sexually with underage fans.
Yeah, which, you know, to me, that band was really also ambitious in a similar way and coming back huge, like before
we saw them play
King's Theater.
King's Theater.
Right before, you know, the allegations came out. Chemical Romance thing.
So here's my thought. My Chemical Romance is Marilyn Manson of this. In the same way that Marilyn Manson was not exactly living in the same ecosystem as Korn and all that other stuff, or even Nine Inch Nails, but had a kind of theatrical aspect that allowed people who wouldn't let themselves be fans of the music. They had to be involved in the scene. They had to be sold in some kind of theatrical big picture way. I think there are a lot of people who would never be like, I'm a Korn fan, but would find a way to Marilyn Manson, or even I'm a Tool fan. Like Marilyn Manson obviously like umbrellas a lot of like adjacent sub scenes at that time, but I think they allow themselves to get into Marilyn Manson because of MTV and because of it's cool to be a fan of a transgressive pop star.
But just size wise, all of those bands though were like arena bands. I think the ones you mentioned that Only My Chem is really an arena band, size band.
And honestly, maybe is My Chemical Romance the last MTV band? Is My Chemical Romance the last
were
band?
Were they an MTV
made?
Band?
Oh yeah.
I worked at MTV during
the
that era.
The end of the music video era was huge for My Chemical Romance.
Absolutely.
Black Parade and Helena specifically.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
As far as its cultural journey, the return of emo, you know, we see this every time a new generation comes into power in terms of journalism and music criticism, mm-hmm. I think, which is that stuff from your childhood that was disrespected
maligned,
at the time,
of course.
Maligned, then when people my age are in charge of tastemaking sites like Pitchfork or Fader or whatever, mm-hmm. they reevaluate. And I think
this is why Gex is so fun.
Pitchfork obviously still plays a big role here in terms of like what music is acceptable to like for cool people who consider themselves into music. And when you think of something like their Sunday Review series where they review an old album, they're praising emo albums, third wave emo albums that came out that would have either gotten like a 0.0 when they were released or would never have been touched by a site like that. And I think even, you know, Spin, Blender, and Rolling Stone were more open to emo at the time because of people like Karen Gans mm-hmm. and Andy Greenwald and people who are.
I will say Ultra Girl. I did work with Ultra Girl Spin during this era, and she helped get MCR on the cover.
So I think basically it's generational and stylistically, you know, fashion wise, maybe you can speak to this more, but the sort of like, you know, it is in conversation with what has happened in rap and then what has been remixed again by a Billie Eilish type, mm-hmm. you know, and it's like bit goth, a little bit Hot
and
Topic.
And this is, again, Lil Peep, Juice WRLD. I mean,
Lil Uzi Vert.
So one of the things that I was most struck about in 2016 or 2017 when engaging with that first wave of SoundCloud kids was how closely they listened to pop punk and emo. And that's true of the white artists and the black artists alike. And I think what you saw in the melodic choices of someone like Peep, and actually really – and this is why, like, even though I'm unsympathetic to the yellow card case against Juice WRLD, I'm not unsympathetic to the notion that Juice WRLD borrows heavily from emo. I feel like clearly that was something that he thought about. I don't think he listened to this third-tier band and said, that song is what I'm going to steal from. But in terms of melodic choices, God, they're going to use this in the lawsuit. This bit is going to get played in the lawsuit.
Keep going.
Anyway, the point is, I understand that he borrowed a lot of melodic choices from that universe. And that was something when we think of music that was maligned by serious people, what we're thinking of is music that was embraced by children.
Youth culture.
Yeah. And so for someone like Peep or Juice, that music is uncomplicated pleasure. And I think aesthetically, I think they were about to have a big reevaluation of kind of basically like Family Values Tour era aesthetics.
Limp Bizkit.
Yeah, like we're about to have a reevaluation of that era. And I think basically the scenes that Sarah is talking about were just like 2 to 3 years early about that. And smart fashion kids and fashion kids have already been moving in that direction. And smart designers are really, I think, probably last season and this season in terms of runway stuff, just starting to really go in that direction. And so trash culture gets reevaluated. Trash culture is not a term I love, but it's like fundamentally culture that was treated that way is always going to get reevaluated. Outsiders are always going to make their way from the margins to the center. And I do think that pop punk and emo of that time is particularly rich, both sonically and aesthetically. And MCR is a great example of a band that works in both of those spaces. It's a band that isn't as successful if you can't look at them. And so I think that influence that you're seeing, it's not actually surprising. I don't know if Sarah is writing because she's surprised, but it's not actually that surprising to me.
Yeah, it's also, you know, one of the things that came with Poptimism.
Never heard of that.
Well,
never
conveniently, I have to leave. I'm so glad you said that word. Thank you, Joe. Gosh. All right. Bye, Popcast.
Paying attention to the tastes of both young people and women. And a lot of these bands, I feel like, had a fan base that was, you know, young, possibly queer, very female. And those subsets of people, their taste is now being considered in a more serious way.
Absolutely.
Rightfully.
Let's talk a couple things that you have some particular insight into. before I call JP up, here's one. This is from Corey Hilsey. Corey says, any info or conjecture on Britney's current working status and the hashtag Free Britney movement in general?
I wrote about Britney's conservatorship a handful of years ago.
And you took a picture with her backstage at her Las Vegas show?
Yes, for journalism.
For journalism, obviously.
The New York Times paid upwards of $1,500
for just, my photo. Can we just officially shout out everybody who approved that expense report?
Yeah. Phil Corbett specifically. I have not followed as closely in the last few weeks and months.
There have been some development.
Yeah, you know, I know there, you know, her father's health has been called into question. She has potentially maybe asked for some changes to the conservatorship. A lot of this, because it's medical, happens behind closed doors and in sealed court documents. So most of the information we have on this stuff is coming from TMZ, frankly.
Mostly legit. Mostly,
yeah, but also Spun. From
sure.
certain sides.
Sure.
And if you follow really closely, you could tell who's leaking to what side.
Yep.
Or what gossip site. You know, The Blast.
The Blast is
the rival to TMZ. I don't think we can expect much from Britney Spears.
Except high-grade, wacky Instagram posts.
Yes, and a jukebox musical made up of Britney Spears songs that is supposedly working its way toward Broadway.
Okay.
In which Britney songs are sung by Disney or fairy tale princesses who are having a feminist awakening. That's my blog line, from what I recall. Pedro just snarfed.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
Moving on.
Also, I do want to recommend following Britney Spears on Instagram. A notebook that I did not write last year, but I would have liked to have written if I had at the time, was about Britney's basically new public art, which is...
Okay, Jerry Saltz.
Sorry, it's just unusual. I think you mean Roberta Smith.
Honestly, Roberta should write that piece.
I would love to read that piece by Roberta. So Britney is doing...
Watercolors.
Yeah, watercolors
and gymnastics.
Yoga, and some of them are really fast cut. They all kind of have this kind of cracked sense of humor. I'm not sure that the jokes are funny, but they're like clearly attempts at jokes. Anyway, I really recommend it. It's kind of reassuring to see a public figure who is perceived to be in some kind of like disregard actually just kind of be like, I'm living my wacky life.
And well, we should also note that the most recent public developments from the conservatorship case that happened last year came out of a podcast that was devoted to close reading Britney's Instagram and then became investigative journalism along the way.
Here's a good question about historical memory intersecting with business interests. This comes from Lauren Cunningham. Lauren says, it is crazy, all caps, to me, and also to me, then the year of our Lord, did I write this? 2020, Aaliyah's full catalog is not available for streaming.
Oh, yeah.
I know her uncle has control of it, and there are complicated reasons, but what is up? Is this a lost cause? That's part one. Part two is, how is the fact that most people can't easily access her music affecting her legacy? I was a teenager when Aaliyah passed away, so I remember all the music and still have the CDs in a box somewhere. And as a fan over the last 19 years, I've seen so much happen in music that has reminded me of her, Kalayla, and how ahead of her time she was as an R&B and pop artist, from Ciara to The Weeknd to Billie Eilish, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, Kalayla. I also know that for younger millennials and Gen Z who maybe didn't grow up with her music, if it isn't streaming, it basically doesn't exist, et cetera, et cetera. So the great grail of streaming, there were a number of grails. I remember there was like a time 6 or 7 years ago where you could plausibly go to an edit meeting and be like, you know what would make a great story?
Mm-hmm.
All the people who aren't on streaming. You can't do that anymore.
The Jay-Z albums are back.
Everything's on streaming. The Beatles are on streaming. Metallica's on streaming. All the holdouts. Aaliyah, not on streaming. So we know a little bit about the business. Her uncle is in control of the albums. They were on Blackground, which was an imprint of Virgin, I believe, at the time. But I believe he is in control of the master recordings.
I mean, the greatest crime of all, which, you know, people who have been paying attention to Aaliyah's digital music know, but the only Aaliyah album you can stream on the major streaming services is AJ it's Nothing But a Number.
Right.
The one, you know,
which done
written
R.
by
Kelly.
R. Kelly. Yeah.
And also the Aaliyah Lifetime biopic had to make some like unusual plot pivots to accommodate the music that they were able to license. Like there is almost none of the real hits are on there, but there is some arbitrary soundtrack song. So there's like a 4-minute scene of them talking about like, oh, you got an opportunity to record for this soundtrack. Some song that I had no memory of whatsoever. So this is a problem.
Yeah, I haven't seen many developments in this. There was a big complex story a couple years back about this.
So Barry Hankerson has never talked about this.
Well, he has also been implicated in the R. Kelly stuff. Aaliyah yes. crimes. So that has potentially moved this further away from being settled in any way, just because he's not a beloved public figure so far.
You would assume it would be either financially expedient for him or at least emotionally expedient to have Aaliyah's music in circulation. And I think the second part of this question is really rich, which is, what does it mean for someone to have had a very established artistic influence and legacy that then somehow dematerializes because the formats change? I think people – look, there's like bootleg Aaliyah stuff. There's stuff on YouTube. Like it's not like impossible to find to listen to Aaliyah. But yeah, it's not on official –
not easy.
Yeah, it's not on official playlists. It's not on official Spotify or Apple Music or any of that stuff. And I think that – it doesn't change the history that has been written, but I do think on a fundamental level, it's a disservice to the legacy that predated these listening mechanisms.
I think it does something very specific to her legacy, which is it turns her into an icon. And I don't mean that in the positive sense. I mean it
fixed in amber.
She becomes a face on a t-shirt.
Yeah.
And she becomes
an expensive t-shirt.
She becomes somebody mentioned, you know, in the same breath as Tupac or Biggie as far as talent that we lost too soon. She is just a symbol, I think, that people use. You know, she's like a Tumblr symbol. She's like a vintage concert tee symbol. She's a, you know, you put her in your music taste if you want to signal a certain type of fealty to R&B. You know, like, I think she's become,
she's not her music.
Yes. She's an not idea. Her song.
She's an idea.
Yes. She's a prop of sorts.
Yeah.
Which I think is really a shame because her legacy, you know, if you dig closely enough, stands up on both of those
100%,
sides. 100%.
Know?
And I think basically she's Tupac. Like, there aren't a lot of Tupac songs that are relevant or known today, I don't think, by a younger generation, but everyone knows the photos and the interviews and the quotes and the middle finger and, you know, like, and to me, I think that Aaliyah...
Are you telling me that Megan Thee Stallion, who just ripped off a Tupac song for her new single, that Tupac is not in the conversation?
I don't think it landed as a Tupac homage to people who are not born when you were born.
I don't know. Maybe they read the New York Times playlist on Fridays, which I first want to say, I go to bed very late Thursday night, every Thursday night.
Just to cook up these takes.
For the privilege of writing about new singles. So I would hope that anybody who was curious about Tupac's influence would have read that.
But I think whenever Aaliyah's music does come back in a more easily accessible way, it will be a moment.
It'll be huge.
Yeah.
It'll be huge. And like the amount of content it will generate will be unfathomable. But to focus back on that question, here's my concern. Number one, I don't want that to happen to Aaliyah. Obviously, the thing that you're describing.
For her to become like a sort of empty icon.
I don't want that to happen for Aaliyah. I do think that the problem is not as much of a problem in this year or even 3 years ago as it will be 10 years from now or 20 years from now. Because I do think that what's going to happen is we are going to start to perceive Spotify and Apple Music and whatever streaming services survive as the official record and as the complete record. So that's bad for Aaliyah.
Every mixtape ever.
Every mixtape. It's bad for Soulja Boy. It's bad for
Lil B.
Yeah, it's bad for Lil B. It's bad for Digital Dripped. It's bad for everything that ever existed on a Z-Share or on a Hulk Share or a Mega Upload. There are all these lost histories. You know, it's bad for Vine. And maybe by that point, it'll be bad for TikTok. Like, who can say? I am really concerned about losing various musical micro-histories because of format changes. And we used to have anxiety about that from 8-tracks to vinyl or vinyl to cassette or any of those things. But we have developed systems to preserve those things, to record them, or to continue to play them. The things that disappear digitally disappear. The files disappear. The players, like Windows Winamp or whatever. Like, if I need a copy of Winamp 10 years from now, am I going to be able to find one? So I'm way more concerned about how the internet is choosing to erase entire histories, Aaliyah being a subset of that.
Should we quit our jobs to do a mixtape
like a
preservation service?
Yeah, like basically like a not Ubu or
the yeah, one for film.
Yeah. We should do that for mixtapes.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, like although
who will fund it? Larry Jackson, call
us. Yeah, serious. Larry, Jimmy, call us. Joey IE, call us. Paul. Puff, please. I mean, just call us anyway. I also want to talk to Puff about his art collection while we're here. But yeah, I mean, when you think about like the rap blog, the MP3 blog era, and all the stuff that was like archived at that time, and most of that stuff's just gone now, I don't get the sense that there's any like, this is like the universal fire, right? This is the universal fire of the internet. And I don't think anybody
burning silently.
Yeah, and I don't think anybody cares. And Aaliyah is one thing, but at least someone can pull the trigger on the Aaliyah stuff and say, well, as of tomorrow, it will be available.
And there have been false starts to that effect. I think there have been a few times when people thought the Aaliyah stuff was coming or was uploaded illegally or whatever. So I think we'll get it eventually, and I really hope that that's the case.
So let's go out with a great Aaliyah song that's not on Spotify. That's If Your Girl Only Knew. JP coming around the corner.
If your girl only knew that you was trying to get in me, what would she do? If your girl only knew that you was kissing her to talk to me,
Starz series Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
My name is Thomas Gibbons-Neff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
JP's on the phone. John Perales is calling in all the way from Lower Manhattan.
It's an undisclosed location to most.
It's true. It's true. It's full of records. It's full of records and critical acumen right there. So, JP, we got a bunch of questions, actually, that were kind of specific to the nature of criticism. And I thought it'd be good if maybe you and I would just tackle a couple of them, because I think that maybe our process would be interesting for people to hear about. And also, I know we don't always have the same opinion on some things. So,
plus, we also think about this stuff 24/7.
Absolutely. So There are a couple general questions and a couple more specific questions, but I'm going to start off with Ben Gregory. And Ben says, I want to be a music journalist, but I'm in a career a million miles away from that. How did you decide your writing was good enough to be worth pursuing? First of all, LOL. And two, I guess a less selfish question, how much weight do you allow your emotion to take in a review? Can you hate something and write a positive review? So the first thing about how did you decide your writing was good enough to be worth pursuing, I'm curious about your answer because mine is funny. So do you have an answer to that?
Well, I just started doing it because I was addicted to getting records in the
mail. That's right. Free. It's all about free stuff.
Free stuff.
Free stuff.
I mean, I had been
if you work at a record label and you're not sending me your free weird hip-hop swag, like you're the strange merch you're making, like you're messing up.
Anyway. And please send me that and everything else.
Yes, that's right.
But I mean, I had been at my college radio station as the music director. I was getting every album that came out and listening to them all and saying, play this song. And I realized that as graduation impended that this is not a radio voice. And I was not going to be getting a job in the radio business. So a friend of mine suggested who was writing for magazines from his dorm room, suggested that I send some stuff out. And, you know, I got an Over the Transom manuscript accepted. This was in the age of magazines and gatekeepers and those kind of things when there were still a limited number of publishing outlets. This was very much pre-blog.
Right. I, on the other hand, have a beautiful face for radio myself.
So I've heard.
When I first started writing, which was in the mid to late 90s, I understood myself really as an enthusiast, but I didn't know if I really fully considered myself a writer for a few years. And, you know, obviously I still look at my writing and think on a lot of days that it's not good enough or it's not at all it could be. But, you know, you write on deadline and you're writing under constraint pressure of space and time, and these are not things that we have spent 6 weeks crafting every tiny little sentence. So I've learned to appreciate the art of being effective and punchy and pointed on deadline, which is a different kind of writing that I quite enjoy, but it's not the only way to be a good writer. And it took me a while to feel that I was good at this kind of writing. Some days I am, and some days, who can say?
Most days you're good.
That's very kind.
But I started as an enthusiast too, actually. I mean, I wrote my first review for my high school newspaper because I wanted to jump up and down and point at something I cared about.
Yeah, me too. My first review was of the first PM Dawn record in the Stuyvesant High School Spectator in 1991 or 1992.
Excellent taste.
Yeah, I was really on one. R.I.P. Prince B. Pedro, can you play Set Adrift on Memory Bliss?
Happily. That's the way it goes, I guess. Baby, you send me
to that second part of that question, how much weight do you let your emotion take in a review? Can you hate something and write a positive review?
I would never, ever hate something and write a positive review.
Yeah.
That would be contrary to the entire racket that we're in. I mean, people are asking my opinion, and they consider it an informed opinion. And if they've read enough of my stuff, they know where I'm coming from. And I mean, I once ran into a guy at a new music seminar who came up to me and said, you're John Pareles. I disagree with everything you write.
Yeah.
And I said, great, I'm a perfect critic for you. You can just like do the opposite
right, exactly.
of what I say. But I would never contradict myself. I mean, part of why you and I are in this racket is for pleasure.
Yeah.
And if we are not conveying our own pleasure and displeasure, if we're not conveying all of our emotions, we're not doing it right, I don't think.
And also, like, you know, criticism is a – it's not just about I like it or I don't like it. It's about storytelling. It's about context. You know, it's about bigger picture philosophy. And I think I want to deconstruct or problematize the terms hate something and positive review, because I think when I'm listening to a record for professional purposes – as if there are any other purposes anymore. But when I'm listening to a record for professional purposes, I'm listening with a lot of hats, I find. I'm trying to think about where does it fit in the broader scheme of pop music. I'm trying to think about, does it move me on a kind of primal level? Does it move me intellectually? How will people respond to it? What type of listenership will it attract? I'm trying to assess all of those things at the same time. And so hate feels like a broad and blunt term, and frankly, so does positive. I think it's possible for me to understand something and even be sympathetic to it, even if I personally don't love it. But I would still give that thing what I think Ben would still understand to be a negative review, because ultimately what I would arrive at was saying, I don't think this is very good, even if other people do, or even if other people think hard about it, or even if other people are passionate about it. So I think I can really dislike something, but find things not to embrace, but to at least aid in my understanding and broader contextualization with.
Well, I also think it's a really good exercise if you want to be a critic as opposed to an enthusiast, to go write about something that you hate and figure out how it works,
yes,
who it's trying to speak
true,
to,
true, true, true,
why you think it's pernicious,
yes,
or lame or cliched or, you know, last year's trick. I think that's a really good exercise as a writer.
Absolutely. I totally agree. That really reminds me of when I was doing criticism in the late 90s and early 2000s. I took on a lot of writing assignments for things that I was curious about but not as much of an expert in as the things that I was a super expert in at the time. And it forced me out of my comfort zone. And I learned about aesthetic frameworks that I was not familiar with. I tested myself, my gut level reactions to a whole bunch of different sounds that I had not previously allowed myself as like a cool hip hop kid, quote unquote, to like even entertain or interact with. And it was really helpful. And I could not do my job as I do it today had I not pushed myself in those directions in, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah. Good musicians, they're not looking at genre lines. They're not saying, oh, I only listen to hip hop. They'll steal from anywhere.
Yes.
The beauty of popular music is that it's a hybrid. It's a mutt. It's not something that stays in its lane. So your criticism shouldn't either. And you should definitely challenge yourself, and you should definitely listen to stuff that might surprise you or, you know, if you're a musician, give you that one thing and you can throw away the rest and use that one thing to make something good.
Totally, 100% agree. So for Ben, if you're trying to be a musical journalist, a good entry point maybe would be to try to push yourself to write about something that does cause you strong negative feeling and try to figure out why.
Also, if I can speak to the entertainment part of what we do, people love a good pan. I don't write many of them because I'm too busy trying to advocate for stuff I love.
Go Google JP's famous Coldplay pan. If you haven't read it, you should.
But even there, I was trying to figure out how it worked before I came down on it like a ton of anvils.
Right. You're like, I know how it works. It's still trash. Anyway, RIP to Coldplay. Okay, next question. This question comes from Grace House. This is actually something I think about a lot. Grace says, I'm interested in your take on the responsibility of the critic when it comes to reviewing and writing about foreign language music, especially now that Spanish language music and K-pop have gotten so popular. Do you think it's important to read a translation or multiple translations and try to understand wordplay and lyrical context, or is it more about the sound? What do you do? Do you have a process for this?
That's not a binary, of course.
No, of course not.
The sound matters, the sense matters. I always go look for a translation.
Yeah.
Thank goodness there are so many volunteer translators out there. There's a good site called lyricstranslate.com, which usually has, on any popular song, more than one attempt, which is nice. Mm-hmm. if I'm desperate, I'll go to, for Spanish language or Brazilian language pop, I'll go to, I think it's letras.com and, you know, stick it into Google Translate, but you usually get gobbledygook.
Right.
I would rather know that there was a human.
Human ears, human fingers on the typewriter.
Human feelings and human, you know, use of context. Yep. You get some real bonkers stuff out of Google Translate. Mm-hmm. The lyrics do matter. I mean, a song's a synergistic combo of music and lyrics, and you got to have an idea of what both are trying to do.
You know, I think about this a lot. I did a thing for Nightline a few weeks ago. No, like maybe 2-3 months ago about Romeo Santos. And they didn't use this part, but I was talking about Romeo Santos as like basically like a great American love song performer. And I was like, you may not understand everything he's saying because he's singing in Spanish. But like you can, you, number one, if you're a casual listener, you can feel the texture of it. And number two, like, did you understand everything Bob Dylan ever said? They didn't use that, unfortunately.
Too bad.
But I do think fundamentally, like when I think about the number of performers of popular music in the English language who people don't understand all the words to, and that means number one, if you don't understand the words to Young Thug or Bob Dylan, like you can still like them, and that goes for Spanish language, Korean language, French language, Portuguese language music, etc. As a listener and as a critic, yeah, I will always try my best to get under the hood of a song or get under the hood of an album to understand what the lyrical themes are. But I do accept on some fundamental level there's going to be a percentage, and that percentage could be 5 or it could be 30 or, you know, on a bad day, 50, that I might not have access to. I might not know all the inside jokes. There might be wordplay that makes sense in Korean that when you translate it into English maybe doesn't make sense. I accept that there's some part of that that I'm going to miss. But also, a lot of times when I'm writing about Spanish language pop or Korean language pop, I'm also writing about big, broad, thematic things, and that can be different than writing kind of like a molecular type of criticism about how wordplay functions. And I think when you're doing broader theme criticism, it allows you more freedom. But yes, I have never written about a song in a foreign language without trying very, very hard to understand what every word means in English.
And as you said, we may not get it. I mean, some Brazilian Tropicália and all the Brazilian pop that follows on to Tropicália mm-hmm. is very concerned with puns and wordplay and things I know I'm not getting and feel very sad that I'm not getting. But, you know, we do what we can. I mean, part of the other thing is as newspaper critics, we're generalists. You know, we're not specialists. I have not written an academic tome on some era of some local music in another language.
Yeah.
There are going to be people who know more than us. And I actually hope that they'll write us and tell us if we didn't get everything, because that's always good to learn.
Yeah, I agree. You know, being a generalist, I think we want to be a 100% peak expert on every single thing that we weigh in on. But also, we are generalists. We cover the entire field. And so there are going to be things that maybe we are not as expert in as we are in others. And one of my goals when I first started this job 11 years ago was to get as close to experthood in as many different spaces as possible, you know, as soon as possible.
Well, I'm still working on
but that's what I was going to say is I'm still doing that. Like, I thought that that would change after the first year of the job or the second year, but it doesn't change because something new happens that forces me to learn as if I am an infant.
Artists are always ahead of critics a little bit.
Sure.
Or the good ones are, which is the whole enjoyment of the job.
And also, there's more music out there to listen to than we could possibly consume. So invariably, when something pops up with a bunch of reference points that maybe is not something that I or you have spent a lot of time living in previously, there's a whole untapped resources out there for us to go back and learn from. That's the part of the job that I actually get the most excited about, is when I get to still learn.
I'm right with you.
Okay, here's the next question. It's a short question, and it's unfortunately just aimed towards me, but I just didn't get to it before, and I'll just get to it really quickly. And this is from Jamie Keelis. Jamie, I'm sorry. I hope I'm pronouncing your last name right. Jamie writes for the Times Magazine, and this is something that Jamie is not alone in asking me. Jamie says, I have been wondering about this for as long as I've been listening to podcasts. Not complaining, truly just curious. Why does John always call an individual song a record, quote unquote? Is this an industry thing? So here's the thing, and this is maybe where there's a slight generational gap between me and some of the people who listen to the show, or a input gap. So if you were listening to, say, like Funkmaster Flex doing late night Hot 97 mix shows, you know, for the last 20 years, you would hear, and this is true, you know, growing up in hip hop in the 80s or 90s, people would refer to individual songs as records. I think partially perhaps because they used to be 12-inch singles. They were pieces of vinyl. Also, I just think there's like a kind of like hardness to the word, like this record. So you would, you know, you hear Flex being like, this new record. And that's just kind of ingrained in my grammar at this point.
So you were kind of imprinted like a baby bird.
Yeah. And so I still talk that way, but I realize now nobody talks that way. And I think sometimes really what that is me showing my age and also who I grew up listening to. So that's
It's also showing your loyalty.
Yeah. I mean, that's the scene that I come from, and that's how people talk in that world. So that's where that's from, Jamie. Thank you for asking. The next question is from Matthew Valerio, and this is also about – this is something that I think we can both weigh in on, even though it's just aimed at me, but I'm actually really curious about your answer to this question. The question is, what does John think of record players? Does he own one? I am 21 and have spent my whole life on iTunes and streaming, but recently perused a record store, and it was an awesome experience. I purchased Future's album Pluto for $13, a bargain for Pluto, which is worth many hundreds of dollars in art. So, okay, I have to confess that the only record player that I own is one of those toy record players that, like, I can't even remember the company, but it's basically like a kid's toy record player. Like, I don't have like a Technics 1200. I have had a better turntable in the past, but the truth is I play some vinyl, but very, very, very rarely. I like to have a way to play it if I need to play it, but convenience, and most things are available on the internet. JP, do you have a record player still? And if so, what do you use it for?
I have a turntable. I have a turntable I've been using since whatever the 80s.
What's the brand?
I think it's the Technics.
Yeah, sure.
But it's not a hip-hop turntable.
It's not a 12.
No, I don't have to scratch. but mostly it's unused. I mean, I do listen to as high a quality as I can coerce a publicist to send. I mean, I listen to WAV files. I've got good headphones. I run my computer through a DAC. I do like good sound.
Yes, this is where JP and I are. Yeah, we differ on this.
But I'm not one of those people who is reverential about vinyl. Because, you know, the second time you play a vinyl record, it's already a little scratched.
Yeah!
I'm not a fetishist about vinyl at all.
CD sound better.
I don't know
about that. Pure sound quality CD sound better.
I don't know about that either. But, I mean, because there is a theory that analog vinyl is the exact waveform recorded by the artist. If, of course, he wasn't using, you know, digital recording in the studio. I mean, if someone has made a totally analog record, the analog record is the exact waveform and the digital recording is a million tiny samples of that waveform, mm-hmm. 44,000 of them per second or something. I can't hear it.
I want to say JP is my elder, but is also my junior in every way when it comes to cool sound things.
There's some geekness
there. Yeah, I don't care if the sound is dusty. I'm not particular about format. I know things are compressed for streaming and for iTunes. It doesn't really bother me. I also think a lot of the music that I'm partial to tends to work in those settings as effectively.
Oh, yeah, it's made for that.
Yeah, as effectively as, you know, a high fidelity setting. The audio recorder that I use for interviews, I only bought that because you told me it was the one to buy. Like, I genuinely have no technological aptitude and also very little concern for format.
Well, I do want to say to podcast listeners, as a public service, if you listen to something with a good drum kit on 128 kilobytes per second, which is what iTunes was for hundreds of years, your cymbals are going to sound terrible.
Okay.
You can hear them. Play it back to back with even a...
Pedro said it's true as well.
Playing back with a 320 or a FLAC or a WAVE, and you will hear a difference. I mean, there is a certain depth that cheap MP3 doesn't use. Most of what I listen to that gets sent to me or that I'm listening to is probably 320 kilobytes per second MP3. That sounds pretty good. Probably placebo effect for most fidelity over that.
Okay. I literally I have no idea what you're talking about. But that's, okay. But hopefully if you listen.
Thank you, listeners.
Yes, listeners, hopefully you guys learn something there because I certainly have no idea what's going on. Okay, here's the last question. And this comes from Justin Tang. And Justin says, hello, all. I am a huge fan. Sometime last year, I met John Pareles and gushed about how obsessed I am with Popcast. He says he did this at the California music thing that you did.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So this is Justin. His question is, having seen how much time and work goes into the in-depth profiles done by the Times, which are amazing, his word, not mine, although it's true, which has been your favorite one to work on in the past few years? JP, you have one that sticks out in your mind?
We're talking print profiles.
Yeah.
No, because I've forgotten them all.
Yeah, I know. We're like, that's true. The details tend to just turn to dust and blow away the minute the piece is done.
I wish I had a great answer. It's just the one you're working on is the most important.
That is the right answer. I was glad you said that because that was the right answer. I was going to say,
plus,
like,
I mean, it's the one you like don't know how to write yet. It's the one you haven't figured out how the pieces are going to fit together. Mm-hmm. It's the one where it's like, oh no, how am I going to get this into the space? And then, oh no, am I going to be able to fill the space? And then, oh no, am I getting it right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
The road lies ever ahead.
Yes, frankly, that is all things that I do. All things go through that exact process. Well, yeah, I mean, when I saw this question, my immediate thought was like, oh, it was like spending all the time with Kanye in Wyoming, or I did a profile of The Weeknd in the magazine, and I got to spend a lot of time with him in Toronto, and that was great because it was like right when he was kind of figuring out how to be a pop star. But also, and by the time this comes out, which will be in a week or two, this piece will be out. But like, it's the piece I'm writing right now, which is not as in-depth as either of those pieces. But like, I went to Dallas this past weekend and hung out with 10K Cash. And like, he performed at like some crazy, in like a banquet hall. It was a wrestling match and a rap show going back and forth between wrestling bouts and performances. And it was wild. It was just like punks and hardcore kids and hip hop kids and kids with mohawks and quasi juggalos and just like every kind of weird kid in Dallas was like all in this one room, and he performed for like 8 minutes or something. And I was like, this is incredible. And like, that is one of the great things about this job, which is that here I am, I've been at the Times 11 years, and I'm still be able to have access and find ways to cover things like that, that who could have even anticipated would exist, no less than I'd be able to go to them. So the answer is almost always the thing you're currently doing or the thing that you're just about to do. So
I have a million happy memories. I mean, the night Bjork took me to the top hip hop club in Reykjavik,
hey!
and danced all night and yelled in my ear that Amory's The One Thing was the best song ever. You know, things like
real
that.
Talk.
I mean, I covered a sacred music festival in Morocco where I saw a trance ceremony. I mean, there's a million. But actually, I mean, I think I'm happier with the experiences sometimes than with the
Pieces.
And with the piece.
Yeah, sure.
I wrote.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a job where we get to learn all the time.
Yeah.
I consider us the luckiest people on earth.
I totally agree. JP, thank you for calling in. I appreciate it.
Great to talk to you.
I know it seems like that's the last question, but actually there is one more question. It's from Kathleen McConaughey. Kathleen wants to know, what is Pedro most curious about? What is his favorite album of 2019? Pedro, get on the mic. Tell the people.
Oh, I didn't expect this.
He's got to walk all the way over here.
I got to turn on a mic. Hold on.
Pedro's walking over now.
Very slowly.
Got a live mic.
Hopefully.
Check, check.
So Pedro has made his way over.
Yeah, to I very slowly made my
the,
way over.
The Coscarelli Memorial microphone.
Yes, indeed.
So what was your favorite album of 2019? Could have been an old record if it wasn't anything new.
I got to be honest. I liked the Vampire Weekend album.
Yeah?
I liked it a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, I liked their first, what is it, four albums?
To be fair, you are a dad.
I am a dad.
So
I am a dad indeed.
Yeah.
I really dug that album. But I mean, I listen to old stuff. You know, you're always talking about how you're old.
Yeah.
And I always giggle mm-hmm. because I've got you by like 12 years, easy. I was just freaked out this past week by the fact that I get a press release touting how the romantic song, What I Like About You,
yeah, yeah.
was 40 years old.
Mm.
40 years old. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm dealing with right
sure.
now. So I have
You're
to
processing.
Actually, I'm processing that right now. And I'm going to go home and listen to Vampire Weekend is how I'm going to process that.
We should go out with a Vampire Weekend song, don't you think?
I think so.
So let's go out with Harmony Hall from Father of the Bride by Vampy Weekend.
Thank you.
No, it's my pleasure.
Took a vow in summertime, now we find ourselves in late December. I believe that New Year's Eve will be the perfect time for their great surrender, but they don't remember. Anger wants a voice, voices won't sing. Sinners harmonize till they can't hear anything. Free from all that questioning, but every time a problem ends, another one begins, and the stone walls of harmony all bear witness. Anybody with a word in mind can never forgive the sight of wicked snakes inside a place you thought was dignified.
That is our show, part two of the listener mailbag. Thank you to everybody for your questions. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody. We will certainly have more mailbags down the line. Thank you for a great 2019, and we're excited about everything that's going to happen with Popcast in 2020. Thanks to Joe. Thanks to Karen. Thanks to JP for calling in. Thanks to Pedro for coming over from the other chair. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us more questions, more thoughts. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com and subscribe to Popcast anywhere that audio content is contented. You know where those places are. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week.
Because I still remember. Anger wants a voice. Voices want to sing. Sinners harmonize.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.